Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, I've decided I want to leave China.
No. We can't grant you asylum.
I think asylum is where I belong after this podcast. This is not what we were intending to lead the podcast with, but...
Because this would require actual knowledge of a foreign policy issue.
But if this was something that was going to be a victory for the State Department and Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration, it may be oops.
Yeah, it may be oops. This is a somewhat difficult ball to get one's hands on.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not entirely clear what the state of this individual is. I mean, he's obviously under extraordinary stresses and incredible pressure and concern for his family and concern for his own welfare,
right,
of course, as well. So what he may say one day or may say to one person or one reporter or one government official or one diplomat in one moment might very well not be what he needs to say in another moment. So it's really hard to get around.
And now I understand that the president is actually playing politics with the Osama bin Laden death?
Well,
what's going on with that, Ron Elving?
There was a surprise visit made this week by the president to Afghanistan to sign an agreement with Afghanistan about our long-term role there. And all of this is drenched in politics, of course. It did happen to be on the anniversary of the killing of Osama bin Laden.
And there's also the 9th anniversary of President Bush's ill-fated, ill-advised perhaps, mission accomplished speech.
On the deck of the aircraft carrier,
right,
Abraham Lincoln. That too. And in fact, it was the 9th anniversary to the day and practically to the hour. So there were all kinds of things that the administration was, if you will, sort of juggling in this. They wanted to do something about the anniversary of Osama bin Laden's assassination, if you will. And they didn't want to seem to be dancing on the grave, spiking the ball in the end zone so much, but they really wanted everybody talking about it. And they also wanted to do something that had to do with that part of the world. So they had this agreement to sign. Apparently, this made a certain amount of sense to do it. And of course, it has to be done in secret so as to minimize the security risk to the president. So they ran off in the middle of the night and came back the next day after several hours on the ground, a signing ceremony, a rally with the troops at Bagram Air Force Base, and a speech to the nation of about 10 minutes duration where the president represented what he was doing there in Afghanistan.
My fellow Americans, we've traveled through more than a decade under the dark cloud of war. Yet here, in the pre-dawn darkness of Afghanistan, we can see the light of a new day on the horizon. The Iraq War is over. The number of our troops in harm's way has been cut in half, and more will soon be coming home. We have a clear path to fulfill our mission in Afghanistan while delivering justice to Al-Qaeda. This future is only within reach because of our men and women in uniform.
And not surprisingly, both the left and right criticized it. Dennis Kucinich, other progressives, said that this is not ending our involvement in Afghanistan.
It's 2024?
It's continuing, and yeah. Somebody so corrupt as Karzai, we're working on a deal with it. That's really interesting. And the conservatives and the Republicans were talking about how he is basically celebrating, as you say, dancing on the grave of Osama bin Laden, not unlike Rudy Giuliani and George W. Bush campaigning on 9/11. I mean, we see this is what happens.
I think that there is, to some degree, there is a necessity for people to react. And to some degree, among the kinds of people you're talking about, the hyper-politicized of the left and right, there is a responsibility almost to speak to those who will view anything negatively. So even though, of course, there were political motivations in the timing of everything the president did this week. And of course, they wanted to get the Osama bin Laden people back on people's radar screen as a plus for the president. It's a little bit hard to imagine that any other president in the same set of circumstances would not be doing something similar. In fact, on the day, Mitt Romney had a news conference at a 9/11 firehouse,
right,
in the shadow
with Giuliani.
With Rudy Giuliani, in order to say, implicitly, I mean, in the visuals of it all, on this day that Osama bin Laden died, we remember the people who died on 9/11. And here's a little bit of what Mitt Romney had to say at that event with Rudy Giuliani.
It was naive of the president to announce he would go into Pakistan. We always reserve the right to go anywhere to get Osama bin Laden. Rather just to say we reserve the right to go where we feel is appropriate to secure the interests of the United States of America, and certainly to track Osama bin Laden anywhere he could be found. I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you.
Yeah, he must have been the only person there who couldn't hear that woman.
Mitt Romney also talked about that even Jimmy Carter would have made the move to get Osama bin Laden had he had the opportunity. He's trying to, of course, bring up, just as the Democrats for years brought up Herbert Hoover, the Republicans love to bring up Jimmy Carter and the so-called weakness in foreign policy. One good observation of that whole event is that while Mitt Romney is having a press conference with Giuliani and talking about 9/11, things like that, but at the same time, he's competing with the office of the presidency. And I think challengers have faced that with going back, well, you could say Nixon in China, but even well before that, that Romney will never have, as a challenger, the stature of what a president does. So you can complain all you want about the president going to Afghanistan, being a political, playing politics. But ultimately, when you're challenging a sitting president, you know that that president has tremendous powers at his command that a challenger will never have.
That's right. And the only flip side to that, of course, is that if things go wrong, we have a terrible terrorist attack in the next few months, or something awful, further awful, happens in Afghanistan, the president owns that too. I mean, there's no way for him to shirk that responsibility, no matter how much he may feel it was not his responsibility.
I've seen something also in some progressive writings in the last couple of weeks that I wonder if Obama is getting a pass on some of this the Afghanistan policy from the left, from the Democratic Party, that certainly Bush would not get. And I say in the sense that when we talked about waterboarding or the torture of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, I'm not minimizing this at all, but during Guantanamo, and how President Bush, Vice President Cheney, the Bush administration was harshly criticized for this torture, this element of torture. And yet we also have the instances of the Obama administration firing drones into Pakistan, where, 1,400, 1,500 people were killed. Is the torture of
a handful of terrorists, as Dick Cheney likes to say,
worse than the killing of 1,400 many innocent civilians? And that's a question that I don't think the Obama defenders has sufficiently answered in this campaign year.
I think that's right, and it's one that will probably affect the number of people who enthusiastically can come out and vote for Barack Obama a second time. Certainly, if you look at some of the blogs, you get the sense that there's a great deal of disillusionment, and part of it is because of Afghanistan. A couple of other things that happened in the campaign this week. Mitt Romney chose a running mate and announced that his running mate would be... No, I'm sorry, that's not true.
No, you read next week's script.
Uh-huh.
This week's script is that Newt Gingrich will not be the nominee. See, it's another broken campaign promise.
Yes,
he promised us. He did say that in January.
He will be the nominee.
And then in February, he promised that he would take the campaign all the way to the convention in Tampa, and he lied about that, too. I think one of the reasons I think I'm glad that Gingrich is out of the race is that he's lied to us over and over again.
I think that there is some evidence to that effect. But look, I mean, we have always conceded that there was one thing that Newt Gingrich could do, and let's hear him do it.
The presidency matters, but so do all the other offices of self-government. If you're truly going to have a wave of change in America, that wave has to occur in many, many places simultaneously. As to the presidency, I'm asked sometimes, is Mitt Romney conservative enough? And my answer is simple. Compared to Barack Obama? You know, this is not a choice between Mitt Romney and Ronald Reagan. This is a choice between Mitt Romney and the most radical leftist president in American history.
You know, I can imagine a lot of bloggers on the left who would love to think that Obama was the most radical leftist president in the United States history.
And I think there are a lot of people who are trying to piece whether there was an endorsement out of there somewhere. and you know, some of the endorsements are so overrated, and we keep doing about this. I think Jim DeMint said it very well the other day. He said, look, who cares if I'm an endorse or not? Mitt Romney is our nominee. To make a big deal over whether I endorse or another person endorses is silly, but...
I would make the argument that Jim DeMint, the conservative South Carolina Republican senator, has more to say in an endorsement than, say, Newt Gingrich. I mean, I think we all know that Newt Gingrich wanted to be president himself. He's said a remarkable number of things about Mitt Romney that were quite damaging and which we will hear played again. In fact, we heard played again this week by the Obama campaign with their internet ad, stringing together many of the damning things that Newt Gingrich said about Romney.
Which is what Republicans did with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in 2008.
And we'll see this in every presidential election and many other kinds of elections forever. But I think that the presidential endorsements possibly mean less in many cases from the people who went the furthest and mean more coming from, for example, this week, Michelle Bachmann came out and endorsed Mitt Romney. And I say that means more because she speaks to a different part of the party. So does Jim DeMint. He is and always has been considered one of the main spokespersons for the Tea Party. If there is a Tea Party, if there is truly a movement still today that would call itself the Tea Party, Jim DeMint is one of its champions. Michelle Bachmann is another. Those endorsements mean something to the people who are least happy about Mitt Romney being the nominee.
True, but we've seen endorsements, and we've seen the Marco Rubio's and the Jeb Bush's endorsements, and certainly Marco Rubio is very popular with the Tea Party. He was the Tea Party darling.
He was popular with them then.
Yeah.
As an alternative to Charlie Crist.
Well, that's true.
And they liked him a lot then. Question mark as to whether or not they like him as much now as he moves around in their consciousness and becomes kind of positioned to be a part of the ticket.
And another endorsement everybody seems to be slobbering over, the potential endorsement, is Michael Bloomberg, the Democrat turned Republican turned independent mayor of New York City.
Yes, and his endorsement would, of course, give you New York City, therefore the state of New York, and therefore that would resolve a question that absolutely no one is asking.
Well, no, I mean, that is exactly that. I mean, nothing guarantees anything. Nobody says that Jeb Bush endorsing Mitt Romney guarantees Florida. Nobody's going to say that if Michael Bloomberg should endorse Mitt Romney, which I don't think he's going to do at all, it makes no sense for him to do that. But if he does it, there's no way in the world that Mitt Romney carries New York. Maybe he'll carry Staten Island, but he won't carry New York City, let alone New York State.
My guess is that endorsements only matter in the negative, in the sense that if Newt Gingrich never does get around to endorsing Mitt Romney, that becomes a negative story. Not supposedly just about Newt Gingrich as being, you know, maybe a little bit, playing the baby here and sour grapes, but about something being wrong with Mitt Romney. So if Michelle Bachmann had refused to endorse him and she had come out and said that, she probably would have gotten more media attention for refusing. And if Bloomberg says, I'm not going to endorse either of these candidates or any candidate for president, that immediately is a story in and of itself and makes people say, Mike Bloomberg wants to run as a third party candidate.
You know, and I agree, and I'm thinking historically about some of the things you're talking about, and it's true. When you think of 1968, how long Hubert Humphrey wanted Eugene McCarthy to come on board the campaign, and McCarthy waited way late,
into
October of 68. I mean, not that it would have mattered, but still, it was something that was holding back. The so-called endorsement by Teddy Kennedy of Jimmy Carter at the convention, on the convention stage.
1980.
In 1980 in Madison Square Garden. I mean, that was a cringe-inducing endorsement, if it was an endorsement at all. But you do remember in history where endorsements do mean something, don't mean something, could have meant something. And I do remember, of course, this year when Christine O'Donnell endorsed Mitt Romney, it was the DNC that alerted everybody about that.
That's
before
right.
The Romney campaign.
That's right. So endorsements are a curious bit of political business and one that perhaps, we spend way too much time paying attention to, but mostly because we're trolling for stories. I know so much of the campaign coverage is about that day, that morning, that afternoon. Who won the coverage this morning? Who won the coverage this afternoon? Which way are these candidacies going on a daily basis? And the Gallup daily tracking poll is the way we can tell whether or not winning this Tuesday or winning this Wednesday or winning this Thursday is winning in some longer sense, in some more significant sense.
But I think one story that the Romney campaign didn't particularly fare well with was the resignation of Richard Grenell, the Romney National Security Foreign Policy Advisor / spokesman, who is openly gay, and the question is, why did he resign and what forced him to resign?
That's right. And clearly there had been a demotion of Mr. Grenell. I mean, he had previously been allowed to be a spokesperson for the campaign on certain issues. He was the person you went to, and he was well known and well respected in Washington and beyond, in members of the media, members of the foreign policy community. So he was somebody you could go to for a Romney camp answer on those issues. He was then told that he was not to do that anymore, and after that he resigned.
The Obama camp is saying that it's part of the intolerance of the right wing of the Republican Party because he's openly gay. Grenell didn't do himself any favors by some of incendiary and snarky tweets he sent out mocking Hillary Clinton, Callista Gingrich, Newt Gingrich, things like that. So
stick to the foreign policy.
Yeah, you don't want an advisor to be the headline and the focus of a story, and Grinnell became the focus, and it was time for him to go.
That's right. He should leave the snarky tweets to people in the media. That's our expertise. So, all right, you were talking about the Tea Party earlier. We were talking about the Tea Party. There is a state where the Tea Party is making a difference in a major Senate primary this week.
Well, yes, it's a Tuesday, May 8th in Indiana. Richard Lugar, first elected in 1976, seeking a seventh term. Now, for the longest time, the Tea Party was angry with Lugar because he was President Obama's favorite Republican in the Senate, that he talked more to Democrats than he talked to Republicans.
Oh, he had taken Barack Obama under his wing, was one of the phrases that we heard, because Dick Lugar was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when Barack Obama was first a freshman senator, and here was a Republican chairman taking this new freshman Democrat under his wing. Ooh,
and yeah, and it's the two wings I hang up. But that's what's the problem. The ideologues in both the Democratic and Republican Party just have no tolerance for people talking to the other side. We saw that with Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas when the left was ready to get rid of her. We saw that with Robert Bennett in Utah when the right was ready and did get rid of him. And now we have it with Dick Lugar. But it's more than just ideology. The fact is, Lugar is 80 years old. He doesn't live in Indiana anymore. When he comes to Indiana, he stays at a hotel.
And bills the taxpayers.
Yes.
And he has paid that back.
Yes, but he doesn't
live there. But the
damage
is done.
Matter of fact, for a while, he couldn't even vote in the May 8th primary because he didn't have a voting residence in the state. And then finally he said, okay, I have this family farm that we've owned for years. I'll register there, even though he doesn't live there and never stays there. So it is ideology, and Richard Murdoch is taking advantage of the fact that Lugar is not angry. And Republicans and Democrats, too, they like their candidates to be angry. There's so much to be angry about. Dick Lugar is not in his makeup to be angry, and Richard Murdoch is an angry guy, but at the same time, I think that Lugar either should have done what John McCain did in 2010 when he knew that he was being challenged by the right.
Or Orrin Hatch, for that matter.
Or Orrin Hatch, too.
This cycle,
he's
another 1976 baby,
right,
who's surviving the Tea Party uprising in Utah basically by working at it full time.
Exactly. We saw that McCain do this successfully in 2010. Looks like Hatch is doing it successfully this year. But Lugar felt like he was above the fray. He was not somebody who was going to just get down in the gutter of those kind of politics. And now that he's running negative ads, it just seems so unseemly for him. And we're talking about predictions. I think Lugar loses, and the question is, one, whether Joe Donnelly, the very conservative Democrat who's going to be the Democratic nominee, he's pro-life, he's anti-abortion, very, very conservative.
So he would have a shot in November against Murdoch, because even though Murdoch's obviously more conservative, he might pick up some Lugar voters.
And that's why the Republican Party is starting to tone down its criticism of Murdoch, because they think this guy will probably be our nominee, and we don't want him going to the general election with all these negative things said by us. So it looks like, I think they're accepting the fact that Lugar goes down because Murdoch is not being attacked by the establishment as he was earlier.
Et tu, Brute, you can just imagine Lugar feeling that's the unkindest cut of all.
Right.
All right, now from Indiana to news of Indian American politicians. Elizabeth Warren, until now not known to be a member of a Native American tribe, has apparently used a rather tenuous connection to an earlier Indian ancestor?
Well, yeah. She is 1/32nd.
Wait a minute. Let me do the math.
1/32nd Native American.
That means she had 64 grandparents?
No, she's 1/32nd Native American. But the thing is, the Scott Brown campaign is jumping all over this, saying that she tried to use this minority status to advance her career. And, of course, she says, oh, the American people really want to talk about the issues that count. I love when the people
I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
They always do. That's a very close race, and one in which the assumption has always been that just because she's the Democrat, Massachusetts is a highly blue state, and is assumed to be in Obama's column, and is assumed to have pretty good turnout, that this would be an ideal year to be running as a Democrat for the Senate. After all, it's Teddy Kennedy's seat. And, but Scott Brown would turn out to have been a short-lived phenomenon. Not necessarily. She's untested in these kinds of waters, and we don't know how she'll deal with this kind of a torpedo.
And one thing we have to acknowledge is that Massachusetts has never elected a woman to the Senate or the governor's race, and very few female members of the House as well. So it's something to watch. But look, until Scott Brown in 2010, how many Republicans in recent decades have been elected to the Senate from Massachusetts? And the last one was?
Ed Brooke.
Ed Brooke in 1972. That's the last one.
Yeah. So that's a long time. In Massachusetts years.
Yeah.
So all right, this is an indication that this is going to be a very difficult race. It's going to be a tough race. With all the advantages that you would think a Democrat would have there, it's going to be a tough race for Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, for both. No, I think it's a tough race.
Because she's
close
an
race.
Untested candidate, and she's going to have sudden, you know, vulnerabilities such as this. Another close race that we're watching coming up in June is the recall election of Scott Walker in Wisconsin. Polls show that extraordinarily close.
Dead even.
Between him and Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee, whom he defeated in 2010 to become governor.
Barely.
That's right. It was the county executive of Milwaukee versus the mayor of Milwaukee, and he barely beat Barrett, and that's how all this got started. That's right. But now we're in a recall, and in voting in June is not something that people are used to doing in Wisconsin.
June 5th, right.
And so the turnout is really going to be the determiner there, and Scott Walker may very well have the more unified party and the more turnout-inclined party, and that would be his ace in the hole going into that contest. The other question is, does Tom Barrett get the nomination?
Well, right. Before we go to June 5th, we have to go to May 8th, and that's the Democratic primary to see what Democrat will run against Walker in the June 5th recall. There are four Democrats on the ballot, but the top two are, as you say, Tom Barrett, a former congressman, mayor of Milwaukee, and Kathleen Falk, the Dane County, which is Madison, basically.
She's the Madison candidate.
The liberal. She's also the choice of the union.
Labor. That's labor. Really
and,
what she is.
And they've spent millions of dollars. They probably would not be a Scott Walker recall had there not been the money coming in from labor unions.
And it's hard to imagine it would have been successful.
But, you know, you talk about all the money.
I mean, it was a huge petition drive. They got a lot of signatures.
Over a million signatures.
But really, from the very beginning, it was the unity, solidarity, if you will, of many private sector unions with the public unions, the public employee unions who are being targeted by Governor Walker.
But when you talk about all the money that's coming in for the labor unions, look at the money that the candidates themselves have raised in the last couple of months. Scott Walker, in the last 3 months, $13.2 million. Tom Barrett, $900,000. Kathleen Falk, $700,000. So all this labor money that we're talking about coming in, and of course we're going to see more between May 8th and June 5th, but right now the individual candidates don't have that much more money, and yet...
Arguably,
and
this
look at
is...
But look at the numbers. They're still running dead even. Scott Walker and the Democrats, dead even.
Well, arguably this is the cumulative force of all these Democratic groups, labor unions, and other groups from outside the state against the cumulative force of Scott Walker's allies, which, of course, you know, he's gotten money from the Koch brothers and from lots of other people who are outside the state or in some cases inside the state, highly ideological people who find him a total hero of their cause. Lower taxes, less governmental regulation.
The state was in big financial trouble when he was elected in 2010.
And it's in better shape today.
It is.
And they point to that. And they say we can be.
But they've lost more jobs than any other state in the country, and that's the Democratic
Party. Oh, you're talking about the state of the government versus the state of the economy.
Right.
And there is the argument, there's the rub. There's a big focus on the size of government and the level of taxation among the kind of business groups that are supporting Scott Walker. And so everybody's got champions from outside the state here. This is a little bit like the Spanish Civil War in the late 1930s, where all these great world powers were sending in surrogates and weapons and money to support the two sides, left and right, in a run-up to what was World War II. You could call this the run-up to the November 2012 election.
And as you know, General Francisco Franco is still dead.
Speaking of Spain, Generalissimo Francisco Franco remains deceased at this time. For up-to-the-minute news concerning any change in his condition, please stay tuned to this station.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Remember the war against Franco. That's the kind where each of us belongs. Though he may have won all the battles, we had all the good songs. So join in the folk song army. Guitars are the weapons we bring to the fight against poverty, war, and injustice. Ready?